Hi, Stanislav is, I think, pronounced good perfect.
Stas, short.
Yeah, but how your parents call you?
Stas. Yeah.
Stas.
The long version, yeah, Stanislav.
Yeah. Stanislav. What was your first computer?
Ooh, I actually not that geeky. I don't know what kind of computer that was. I remember it was 2005.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have a computer for a long time, only when I turned 15. And I used it mostly for Need for Speed.
Uh-huh.
And Heroes of Might and Magic.
Heroes of?
Yeah, it's an old game from, I think, 90s. It's still quite popular in China and Slavic countries. But yeah, and then I started to do some programming, but I started from Hush, C#.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and only then switched to Java.
But I think Need for Speed, Have a Nice Day. It was another racing game, which was very old. Have a Nice Day, I think, was the name. I thought this is Need for Speed, and I think it was available forever. Have a Nice Day, I think. I don't know, maybe I'm hallucinating right now, but yeah. And you started with C# right away. Why with C#? Why you started programming if gaming worked so well for you?
I don't know. I think it was accidental. I haven't heard by that time about Java. I would assume it was popular in universities, maybe. I don't know.
Okay.
Before that, I only knew Pascal.
Okay, then how you started with Pascal?
We had some lessons in the school.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and you enjoyed that, or?
A little, yeah. Yeah, I liked it. Yeah, we had like two of the guys from my class. We liked computers and programming, so we started to hang out and learn some programming. But then it was, I think, a little C++ and then C#.
Wow, not bad. So at school, so what you did outside the school with Pascal, with your colleagues, and you know, said you hanged out. So what did you try to implement?
Not much, because I didn't have a computer myself.
Okay.
So we could only talk, and we would do exercises for the school. And only when I got the computer, I bought like a book like this about C#.
Uh huh.
This huge book. Yeah.
Do you remember the title?
No.
Huh. Java in a Nutshell, I think, was one of the first books I bought.
I started with Horseman.
Uh-huh.
What's the name? Horseman.
So the author is Horseman or the
title? Yeah. K. Horseman, Core Java.
Ah, K. Horseman. Okay, I know that guy. This is a nice guy. Yeah,
okay.
The Java guy, K. Horseman, of course. Yeah. He now lives in Germany and still writes book. Yeah. Is still around, and he attended Java 1 and all the conferences, so you can still meet K. Horseman. But I thought, you know, your C# book was interesting because there are legends around Java book in Germany. There is like Java is also an island, for instance, and very thick book, you know. And you like C#, or what was your impression? So
I didn't have any reference to compare to. So yeah, it's fine. And I think people who switch between Java and C#, they also doesn't matter as much, I guess.
But because my first serious book about programming was actually C++, programming in C++ from Bjørn Strøstrup, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I read it and then I bought several editions, and I just liked that without knowing why. Because it was complicated and I tried to understand the concepts, and then I got the concepts and I liked that. So especially operator overloading. So this is why I'm asking, because back then I just liked it. I had no comparison as well. Mm-hmm. So I had a little bit basic and Tour Pascal as well, but I never read a book, I think, about Pascal. But this was my first, I think, book about programming I ever read. It was from Bjørn Strøstrup, and I like everything. I remember Edison Wesley, layout, design, content, and I was actually happy that I could understand something out of the book. This was, you know, my success story. And the Java books were So then I was convinced that Java is the big next thing. So I just enjoyed all the Java books, right? So this is why I'm asking, you know, what was the feeling about C-sharp books? Mm-hmm. So you just read it to know something. You're very pragmatic and no emotions, or, you know, you really like C-sharp or the ideas or Microsoft or I don't know what. It's just, you know.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it was just I liked the programming, the uh-huh. idea of programming, mm-hmm. but there was no hard feelings about the programming language itself. Mm-hmm. And what was your biggest problem when you read your first book? Like, what was the topic that was the most complicated and weird for you?
I didn't know anything, actually. So the very first book, I think it was like Intro into Unix. And I thought a lot about root. So they mentioned root. It's like root. This is like, you know, of a tree. It's like, this is really strange. Why? And this was for me like science fiction. So why? This is complete strange topic. So I didn't knew why root was called root.
And exactly.
A few years later, I got the concept that root is the root, you know, and this is why this like hierarchical. And they mentioned trees and roots, but I say, okay, tree and root and operating system. And I had back then, I think, Windows 95. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, Windows is obviously better because there are no roots. You know, it's just, you know, no users and no trees. Like, what are you talking about? But I knew it's somehow important. So then I was fascinated by all the names and terminology and stuff like that. I can remember in C#, I think the problem was pointers in general, in my case, because as I started programming with BASIC, there were pick and pokes, and they were, for me, black magic. It's like, what? Mm-hmm. You know what pick mm-hmm. and pokes are? With a poke, you can write something to memory. This is like two parameters. It's like mm-hmm. 65,255. And pick, you can read from memory. And there were some geniuses who could, you know, write something to memory, and you got endless lives in a game. And I say, mm-hmm. how did they get it? This is like, I have no idea. No, I had no concept of that. And I was happy that I got the pointers. And if I got the pointers, I could do pointer to a pointer. And back, this was just fascinating me, right? And in Java, I like C++, and then I learned about Java. And in Java, I had no idea why interfaces are nice or great or whatever. It's like, this is not nice, because in C# there was include H, so the header files, you know, and C++. The header, mm-hmm. yeah, C++, and they are clearly separated. And in Java, is like half thing, you know, it's an interface. Yeah, you can do this, but why? So also, and no operator overloading. But I read about the ideas, and I said, okay, the idea sounds right, but I never had a problem in C++. So for me, it was like, you know, maybe like C++ for non-programmers was my impression of Java at the very first beginning, right? So this is like something like this. And but the real problems, I always had problems, but I tried to solve them. So I had just problems all the time. So I, you know, whatever I do, there are problems. So this is, for me, it's just problems. And then you try to find the solution. Mm-hmm. Pretty cool. But what do you implemented with C#? So what was your first idea?
The first one was the calculator.
Of course, and this is actually hard. So because, like, you have evaluate formulas, how you did it? It was like you had to implement a parser.
Actually, it wasn't a calculator, sorry. It was a game where you have like I think it was 15 squares, and you had a hole. And you could move the squares only into the hole, and then the hole.
Almost like Tetris, but
not Tetris.
But this sounds complicated. It was a visual game.
Yeah, and C# is a desktop thing, so
yeah. But this is crazy as a first application. Yeah.
No, I wouldn't say you only like you have a grid of buttons, and when you press a button, you find in the cell that is free. Next to it, and you move that there, so it's not that
cool. Hard.
And the idea is you resort it so that all the numbers mm-hmm. that started to be random are now sorted.
But you used C# also for something, you know, beyond games, like for business or an application, or was it?
No, I studied it maybe for a year, mm-hmm. maybe a little more, and then I decided to go and find some courses on programming instead of doing it myself. And mm-hmm. lo and behold, there was Java. And the course, it mentioned like J2SE, Java 2 Standard Edition, and like, what does this even mean? Like, and I started to Google and then found some new language for me. So, yeah.
Cool. And which year was it, or which on the
it was 2007, I think. I started with Java 6.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, this was modern Java, I would say. Annotations, everything was modern, in place. So you never met, you know, the real stuff, like lots of XML files and, you know, deployment.
No, script. It was lots of XML files back then as well.
Okay.
Remember, I think Spring 3.0 started with the annotations, and it was 2000.
Spring had more XML than Java, I remember. So I was, someone asked me to help them, and they said, they built a... I couldn't help them because I had no experience with Spring. Also back then, I never did actually Spring, but they asked me to help them, and they building, you know, the oil towers and sea, and they had a Spring. And they say, we are lost. We have more XML than Java. I still remember this. And I was like, what's there? It's like, just obvious stuff, you know, interface input. I was like, okay, I had no idea. And you learned Java because you wanted to work with Java, or what? You know, what's your motivation?
I learned it by accident, because this was the course that was in my city at the time. I went there and...
This was a in-person course.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
And was my first experience talking to a real programmer. So
it was a nice course, you know, from...
It was okay. Like, right now, I would think that I would drop a couple of topics, maybe introduce some other topics. Like, this was the first time I was exposed to hash tables. It was very fuzzy to me. For some reason, they decided to include EJB2 in the course. Just a couple of lessons.
But then you got some XML already?
Yeah.
But Java 6, there were EJB3. This is crazy, because Java 6 came with EJB3, and EJB3 were actually nice. One annotations and you are done. So actually, this was really, really lightweight. And the interesting story at the beginning was the EJB3 was Java 6. You only needed one annotation. And Spring
was it at the beginning of Java 6? Like together they were released?
Java 6 and Java 6 were as of 2007 for sure, because I remember 2006 I started with Java 5 because I used NetBeans a lot, and I think NetBeans 5 or 6, they supported also Java 5 and Java 6. And Java 5 and 6, they already had the EJB3, and you could deploy the entire thing in one war. And the funny thing is, because you mentioned Spring and XML, and I could actually all my... There are still conference onlines where I did it on stage. I just used at stateless, and I was basically done. And you didn't even need an interface. You could just go with the Pojo. And what I remember is that the Spring back then said that annotations are not meant for production. Mm-hmm. This is just dev. This auto-wired. Auto-wired is not meant for production.
Auto-wired.
And you have to explicitly configure everything in XML. And I say, this is strange. I mean, I never did it. And with EJBs, and there was actually, we got a lots of project just because of that, because EJB3 were so lightweight back then. Mm-hmm. This is actually part of the story. And what I remember, I think then Spring said, okay, maybe auto-wired is for production, whatever, because then they also look almost as lightweight as EJBs back then. I remember the Java 5, Java 6 days, because there were lots of projects and they wanted to migrate from EJB2, you know, and ask me what to do. And no one was aware that EJB3 are so simple. So you could delete home interfaces, local interfaces, the deployment descriptor, and you put one annotation on it, and you had basically a class. All public methods were available. You eject the class and you were done with @inject. And the cool story is, recently I had to migrate to Quarkus. So what we did is we just renamed the @EJB to @inject, and @stateless to request scoped and transactional, and it mostly worked. So this was actually, my clients were happy, because, you know, there were no big migration in the recent 20 years. So it was actually a huge success story, if you ask me, because my clients told me they focus, you know, just on the business. They forgot all the frameworks, funky stuff, and it worked. So you had an early experience with EJB2, in EJB3 era, so it was not a good course.
For a couple of lessons. It was certainly EJB2, because you say home interfaces and stuff like that, and I remember these names, but it was very confusing at the time.
Mm-hmm. And what do you what happened afterwards? So your first business experience was with Java?
You would think that. I started to look for so I kept learning. So I think it was probably 2006 because I kept learning for some time myself. Mm-hmm. I studied Swing. I started to write some nice GUI stuff.
You are good with Swing, with UI? You like that? Or
quite good, I would say.
Okay, cool. So a visual person. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not necessarily now, but right now, if it's visual, it's JavaScript and CSS, etc. But
for me back then, you know, if I did Swing, the button was as big as the frame works. Okay, you know. And then I make it a half smaller, you know, whatever. It was just, I think, the flow layout. The simplest possible layout you can get. If it worked, I was happy, you know. If someone asked me, you know, it looks not nice, like, who cares? It is a big button, push it, and it's done, right? This was my attitude back then.
No, I was trying to do very nice interfaces.
Yeah, you see? Uh-huh.
Yeah. But then I started to look for jobs, and I couldn't find a Java job. So
really?
The only job that I found was Delphi.
Ah, okay.
Because I was inexperienced, I guess. So yeah. Mm-hmm. So I worked for almost a year at Delphi company.
In 2008?
2008, yes.
This is crazy.
Yes.
Because in Germany, there was a conference like Delphi, and it was called EntwicklerCon. This was like a developer conference. And there were Delphi and Pascal people and Java at the same time. And already in 2005, I think Java was orders of magnitude bigger than Delphi. And what I enjoyed, because there were developers, the famous European Delphi programmers. And I remember one guy who created for Swiss Army some applications. So I spent the time with them, actually. So instead of talking to Java people, I was interested in what they are doing. And we had a nice conversations entire time. So I learned a little bit about Delphi. But Java in Germany was always bigger than Delphi, actually, as long as there were lots of Java projects, but I was not aware of Delphi projects. And no one asked me about Delphi. That's interesting.
Yeah.
But I like Delphi.
Yeah. I think it was a bad luck for me. I started to learn some Delphi again and went to Delphi forums online. And then I would talk to people and say, well, how come people don't write in Java? It's supposed to be very popular. And they would laugh. No, Delphi is much more popular. And so okay. I guess it's because it's like people who live in a community, they
know
only things within the community. I knew only Java. They knew only Delphi. So it was a complicated conversation all the time. But I think it was a bad luck. I think Java was a lot more popular back in the day, even in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
But I hated my job at the time.
What job was it?
So we were writing some desktop software for lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
It was a complicated software, but...
In Delphi,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And the practices that we were reading back then about good programming practices, etc., they were not applied at Delphi. And at that time, to me, I was a very young person at the time. And I think because of that, it was a rejection. Morally, I didn't want to do that. So I was quite bad at my job. And at some point, it was mutual that we should stop working together with that company. And then I found a Java job.
Hey, cool. And, you studied computer science?
I wouldn't say studied. I went to, I think it was more application level programming, my university. I didn't pay attention much because I was already employed, and I was concentrating on self-studying rather than the university. Yep. And the university, I picked the one that was the easiest rather than most useful, which because now I regret. Yeah.
This is what I also think. If I would study once again, so I would just pay more attention to the details, because back then I couldn't use the knowledge from university, but I could use my Java knowledge in the wild, you know? So this was the difference.
Now I try to restudy all the computer science that I should have studied. Now it's very interesting. And maybe it's like, I don't know what's your take on this, but I think there are two kind of people who, when they study something, there are people who want to start with something that is already usable and they don't know the basics, the fundamentals, and they start from the top. and then they go down. And then there are people who can start and they're fine with learning the very fundamental things, even though there is no on the screen, there's nothing useful to it, but they can go from bottom up. And I think that approach is a lot faster to be an expert in the field. Mm-hmm. And I'm the top to bottom guy.
Top down. So you learned the basics first?
No, I learned I learned enough basics to start writing the software that can do mm-hmm. something. Mm-hmm. And only then I started to dig deeper.
It depends. But what I don't like at all that I know that I have no chance or no, there would be no time to understand it. For instance, Scala. So I started, I was just curious about Scala. So I implemented some code in Scala and then I clicked on a Java Scala class and couldn't understand at all what happens. And then I asked, you know, the Scala community, what's up? And they told me, yeah, I'm just application developer and this is not meant to be understood by application developers. In Scala, they are library developers and they are develop libraries. Okay, they immediately lost interest. Okay, this is strange. But it's a mix. What I usually do if I have learned something, I read, you know, just read as many books as possible on topic, just for fun. The first book I cannot understand, the second is easier, and then I get the idea because every author describes this a little bit different. Maybe now I would read blogs or whatever, it doesn't have to be a book, but back then I read books. And if I start working, then I start to implement something, Hello World, very simple stuff, basically. And then I try to grasp the concepts and I continue to, you know, read and do whatever I find about this topic. And then I got a good feeling, get a good feeling. And then I'm still not an expert in the topic, but at least I know what can go wrong, you know, what to do and how to help myself. And then I'm happy. And then from there, if it's important topic, I proceed with the topic. If it's not that important, then I do something different, right? So, but I think it's a mix of both approaches for me, because sometimes you don't have time to quit everything and start with the app. So you can, you know, proceed your old projects and you can already knew something, learn something new incrementally. So you read about complete different stuff almost for fun. And then you get knowledge in the other topic and then you can apply it in one point of time. This is more time efficient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I guess from the mathematics, some computer science point of view, if you were to spend 4 years maybe studying that subject and then
this would study. Be hard. This would not for me. This is too. This is maybe too deep, right? Mm-hmm. Even this is comparable. If you would start to Java to start with the bytecode, you know, this is not that level. This is too deep. So, but let's say Java E was like that. So I try, you know, I attended Java 1 conferences. I try to, you know, to understand as much as possible about, I think it was Java Professional in J2E then, this was early 2000s, to understand what's going on there. And then read a little bit of specs, never the entire spec, but a little bit, programmed something, read books, you know, attended conferences with like incremental development, incremental understanding. And then projects happened and I kept learning. And then I got my own opinion. So, okay, actually we don't need this, we don't need this. And I delete a lot of stuff and the essay, essence happened, and this is how I learned, for instance, J2E. And Java was similar, because Java at the beginning they were applets, but I had no use for applets. For me, it was always backend. But I look at that and then started with backends. Then I learned about, you know, CGI, what the others are doing, then Java, what's the difference. It's just, you know, just get the context right, I would say.
Mm-hmm. So what about modern days? Why are you so into Quarkus? What does give to you? And
To Quarkus is very simple, save money. So Quarkus is the fastest, it starts fast, and most of my projects are in AWS, some are on Azure, most of them on AWS, where I actually coding most of them right now, 99% are on AWS. And mm-hmm. Quarkus starts even a little bit faster than Micronaut. I think there would be no difference. So Micronaut and Quarkus are very fast. And that's all. And if I tell management we use Java to save money, I get the project, and that's all. And another reason is I have lots of J2E projects. I help my clients with Jakarta E, Java E, Glassfish, then Payara, JBoss, Whitefly, WebLogic. And the projects were successful, and developers like that. So the projects, if you would see the code, actually I do this from time to time at conference, I showed what I did 10 years ago on stage and migrated the code to modern Java, for instance. I was delete a little bit, but not much. And recently I was on a conference in Romania, DevTalks. And I remember I delivered a talk, Java User Group, about Java 6 back then. It was roughly 2006, 2007. And I found the code. And this year, I also showed to developers, look what we did. And it was actually right. So there were annotations. It was not much to delete, you know. So and we can migrate the old code to Quarkus with no efforts, for instance. Mm-hmm. So if there were, and this is what my clients love, for instance. So there were the continuous support over the years. We just make everything faster and leaner without changing the infrastructure. And my clients focus on business logic. And this is where it shines, I would say. So, yeah. And Quarkus, I mean, so just briefly, I was surprised how Quarkus works because maybe you know Whitefly and JBoss, and I was always in touch with the JBoss and Whitefly developers. I like them and met at conferences and had huge respect because they were really, I don't know, they were like, you know, true hackers and nice people. And I remember back then, I recorded a training for Red Hat about OpenShift and microservices. And they told me, like, you know, we working on something, you will really like it. You have to look at this. And I had no interest because back then Red Hat had Thorntail. This was like small runtimes and they were not that small. It was a little bit smaller. I was completely, there was Payara Micro, Thorntail. This was like stripped down application servers, but I was fine with application servers. So these small things, I couldn't get the concepts why I should, you know, save 5 megs of RAM with huge ceremony around. So, okay, this is a huge effort. And actually for my clients, it's a zero added value. And Quarkus happened and I look at the Quarkus and I didn't want it first. But then if I saw what happens, like this is crazy because what Quarkus does is it deploys at build time. So it is complete reversal how application server operates. So the application servers like Whitefly, Glassfish, and so forth, you deployed your war.
Yeah.
The application servers read, you know, the contents, read the metadata, read all the stuff. So it means the applications of it were bigger because they had to have XML parsers, everything on board. And of course, they had to parse, you know, the war. So the entire machinery was complex. And also the wars were supposed to be independent. So the application server was like operating system. So there will be complex class loader hierarchy. Every class loader, you know, just consumes some memory. But in Quarkus, it is completely the reverse. So all the machinery happens in build time. And what Quarkus ships is very simple bytecode, no XML, because all the XML is read at build time. All the annotations, metadata is read. And what Quarkus does, it optimizes the bytecode. So it just generates the bytecode with the metadata. One class loader, it starts crazy fast. And I would argue it cannot be a lot of faster because it is actually maximum reach. And this is why I use Quarkus. So I would say no plumbing, simple code, crazy fast, and standards. So this is like, you know, this is like the killer weapon right now in my projects. If I explain to my clients, we have the projects all the time.
I should take a look because I've never tried it.
You will like it. I think as I know it, so you know, what I saw your presentation. So I think if you look at this, you have to like it. So I think there is hard to criticize the concept. Okay, implementation. So if you look at the implementation, maybe you will find something. I have no idea. But from the concept, it's perfect. And even tree shaking is built in. So if you have lots of beans which are not used, Quarkus won't start them up. And recently, there was a migration from Spring Boot to Quarkus, and I asked developers about their experiences, and they told me it's crazy developer experience in Quarkus. So this is like almost like PHP. So you change something, reload, and this seems like Spring Boot is different. I have really no idea. I never did Spring Boot. But this is, I'm always curious because people ask me, what's my opinion about Spring Boot? I have no idea, so I can only repeat what the others are saying, right? So,
I mean, Spring Boot seems like an overload. People stopped understanding what Spring is because all Spring Boot does is auto configuration.
Okay.
Like you used to define everything explicitly. Now there are some defaults. it looks up some whether classes are in the class path or something like that. And to me, this is a completely useless tool. Like, it was never a big problem for me to start a project. Like, you copy some configs from your old project and you're done. And then Spring Boot hides a lot of this because you have to find all this auto configuration. You don't know how it starts. And it's very hard to debug it because there are so many moving things in the runtime. Okay. So every time you want to customize something, you don't like how Spring Boot does this, you want to change it, that's a nightmare. You spend a lot more time debugging this thing than if you didn't take Spring Boot in the first place. Like, just use your Spring MVC if you're into a Spring framework. Use Spring MVC, Spring IOC, and that's it.
But in Quarkus' case, what it is, in Quarkus' case, the conventions are coming not from Quarkus rather than MicroProfile. So it was no change, you know, to the application servers, because in MicroProfile or Java EE, the convention was, if there is only one, you don't have to configure it. So if you have one implementation of an interface, you inject the interface and you are done. If there are two implementations of an interface, you get ambiguous dependency error. It was always the same error in all application servers, and Quarkus does the same. The only difference between Quarkus, Payara, and the others is, this is the cool part, because Quarkus reads the metadata at build time, you get the error at build time, not at runtime. This is the cool. So if you run Maven, you get already the error. You don't have even to start Quarkus. And on the other application servers, you get the same error, but you have to start the application server first. So this is why I like Quarkus, because for me it's the 20 years old technology on steroids. So, you know, there's nothing to relearn, absolute standards, and crazy efficient. So but for me, there's...
What if the project was quite large, like, I don't know, 200,000 lines of code?
This is not large, no problem.
So it's still fast to start.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm actually surprised that this concept works so well that Quarkus is able to build so fast. This is what I will have to invite someone from Quarkus team. Whether they found, you know, some limitations, because for my projects, it works as good as the other application servers. And you don't have to create a war, because Quarkus builds everything. Maybe that's the reason. So there is this one step omitted. So for me, the build of Quarkus was faster. 200,000 lines of code is not that bad, I would say. So it should work. What always the problem, we have lots of Hibernate stuff like that and name queries. So then you spend a lot of time because the queries has to be validated against the database, right? But this is not Quarkus. You have the problem always if you do something at build time and you have to connect to database or something. Mm. But if you're interested, you should really look at Quarkus and then take a look at Micronaut, because both have similar concepts, complete different implementation. So the Micronaut uses a compiler. Extensions, I forgot the name. So it founds annotations, you know, compiler does something about that. So this is the Micronaut strategy, and Quarkus is like extensions. So there's a build and runtime extension, looks like a standard Maven dependency, but this extension prepares the actual dependency. It quirkifies that, right? So it for instance, Hibernate, it would use at build time the Hibernate XML and generate efficient bytecode. There will be no XML at runtime, for instance. And all my projects right now, I think 90% of my projects right now are serverless. So quick startup times, Lambda is crucial, and Quarkus is perfect. So we have Lambdas with 500 Java classes, no issues, for instance. Very cool. But I'm more interested about you, because what I'm telling you right now, I have to, you know, in every project, I have the same conversation. They ask me, why Quarkus? But what is your first Java project, you know? So you said, your first Java job. After Delphi.
So first Java job was in the entertainment.
I'm curious the kind of entertainment, you know, this would be interesting to know.
Sports entertainment. Like
sports, okay.
Madison Square Garden, they have New York Knicks, et cetera. And I built a website for New York Knicks.
So you are people. USA?
No. Just
this is a crazy reference.
Yeah, but that website is not available now, so...
Doesn't matter, but still, that's cool reference.
Yeah. And it wasn't a complicated project. It was like servlets. two months. Servlets? Thing. Yeah. Servlets plus Hibernate plus Spring. So yeah, standard stuff.
Yeah, but this is crazy. This is one of the nice to know. So this is NBA, you said, right? NBA or
New York Knicks? Yeah, NBA.
NBA, it's crazy. So yeah, on your LinkedIn profile immediately, you know, I built NBA, you know, content management system.
I'm not very proud of that project list.
If it's no more Derek, who knows? You know, this is like, you know, this is like cool, very cool. And you work for NBA then?
It was like we were third party to them, so it was subcontracting. So yeah,
super cool. And then after your NBA experience,
so I worked in the entertainment for maybe a year, and then went straight to banking, the usual career, I guess, for a Java developer. I went to work, the projects were for Barclays Capital first, then UBS, then Raymond James, started to do CI/CD in 2012. I made a shift from Java development to actually CI/CD engineer. And then,
Jenkins?
So we were heavily on Jenkins. Even had to patch Jenkins and work on the source code a little. We were creating practices within the companies, like the way to like standardizing things between teams, how things are built, how things are versioned, how things are deployed. The hardest part is usually the working with Git, like onboarding people on trunk-based development is usually the challenge.
Are you a for trunk-based development?
Trying to, as much as possible, use trunk-based development.
Very good. This will be okay. Topic maybe of the next episode, because I'm also for it. And in every project I try to explain why we should not use branches, whatever. You can do whatever, but we will always build everything globally. I had the conversation last week, actually.
Sometimes I don't like, for some use cases, trunk-based development, especially when the database schema is changed, because it's very hard. Like, if you make a mistake in your architecture, it's very hard to change the database back and migrate the existing data. So for that thing, I would rather it stays in the branch for some time. We do a proper review, and then only then goes to the trunk. But most of the time, yeah, I would rather prefer trunk-based development. The next challenge
By the way, do you ever met Kozuki or Kosuke Kawaguchi? This was the creator of Jenkins?
No.
I had a podcast with him, like how Jenkins happened. Nice. So you have to listen. So lots of fun. This is how Hudson and Jenkins happened. Yeah. Nice guy.
Did you discuss the drama?
Everything. Yeah. Drama and how it happened. And was interesting. This is the episode 143. So it was like 130 episodes back. How Hudson and Jenkins happened with Kosuke.
That's cool.
Yeah. And I met him several times at Java 1, and he was like a genius. So what? A really nice guy. So I had lots of fun at talk with him. Yeah. About that? So pretty cool. So you were in Jenkins CI/CD, various banks with Java, right? So many Java. Yeah. And you like Java back then?
I like Java and still like Java. I don't like the new Java, I would say.
Oh, really?
I'd rather code in Java 7. And most of my code, I don't use streams all the
time. That's cool. So next episode will be why Stan loves Java 7, you know? Stan's Java 7 practices. But this would be cool. I can imagine why. Better performance in for loops and stuff like that. So not like, but rather than you get something out of that, right? If you do that.
Yeah, I like the simplicity. Like, everyone knows what a loop is. No matter from which background you are, you know what a loop is. While streams...
This is interesting. So the next episode has to be about that, because I really like streams and I try to avoid for loops altogether right now. And I think... really good experiences. And I also think if I would do everything with for loops, it would be a little bit faster, but I still think it wouldn't matter because we are fast enough, you know. This is but I think you are in complete different area. So this is what I heard in Helsinki as we met the Java user group. So we are different. I'm more in boring enterprise projects and you are high performance projects, so maybe this is a difference, right?
Not yet that high performance as okay. But I'm trying to research more and more stuff into that direction, mm-hmm. and try to build stuff as fast as possible, so mm-hmm. that whenever if I need at some point a scale of I don't actually go and do horizontal scaling. I'd rather add some more hardware and keep it
Then you will love machine. Quarkus, because usually it doesn't matter in my projects, but it's an interesting anecdote. So one of my clients actually asked me to deliver high scalability with Quarkus workshop. So I prepared, and then during the workshop, and they asked me, no, because Quarkus is able to have reactive programming, so with reactivity and they wanted to actually, I think they wanted to learn reactive programming with Quarkus back then. And I asked them, you know, what's your the service with the highest requirements regarding scalability? And they say, okay, there's a service, and there's like, what's the traffic? And they say, okay, peak 2,000 transactions per second. And I say, okay, this is not a lot, because Quarkus out of the box does 15,000 transactions per second. And if you do it right with reactive, roughly 30,000 transactions per second. So I say, okay, you could do the reactive, but we are already now 15 times better than your highest demanding service, and all the other services are less than that. So regarding scalability, you will love Quarkus. And what Quarkus also ships right now with virtual thread support, which I think you like. So there is one annotation, run on virtual thread. And if you understand the event loop and so, you can build highly scalable applications. Mm-hmm. And if you enjoy performance, you have to look at this podcast for episodes with Francesco Nigro. And this guy is performance engineer, and he optimizes Quarkus. But he's also a breakdancer, which is fun, because he's a breakdancer and he's just crazy. He built own load generator tool just to have the highest scalable. And if so, he talked at a conference. He registered a talk just because one measurement of a stress test was wrong, and it explained why. So he is the right, you know, performance person. And he's obsessed with performance, and we talk about what Quarkus does and so forth. So I think from the scalability perspective, right now it is hard to be better than Quarkus. It is not, I don't need that, because right now all my serverless project is more like, you know, one process, one Quarkus. So maybe I will get a project where we have, in one project we use Fargate's ECS like container. So there will be multiple threads in one Quarkus, but usually it is not. But for you, if you're interested in it, it is just golden.
Is Francesco
and Nigro is his name, mm-hmm. and I give you the Nigro with E. And for mm-hmm. instance, the last episode was 343 Apache Storm Disruptor JC Tools, and he is also committed in JC Tools. He commits everywhere with everything performance related.
343
Yeah, you have to listen to all the episodes. It's just 350 hours. So and very cool. So Jenkins, and what happened afterwards? So this is actually quite a journey. So banking, by the way, I was not that much with banking. This is interesting. Banking, insurance, really? Not that much. Yeah. So banking projects, I think just I helped a client to migrate to Open Liberty, his lightweight application server. This was bank and a little bit, yeah, but not that much banking and insurance at the beginning in 2000s and then no more. So yeah. What happened after your CI/CD experiences?
So at that time, so it was 2013, uh-huh. a very popular thing was automated QA engineers. And we were doing lots of testing. We had like full-blown
pipelines. You say we, this is like a group of people or a company?
It was a company, yeah. Uh-huh. We were building things for American stores usually. But cool. I guess in general in the world, automated QA engineer mm-hmm. was very popular, mm-hmm. partly because of continuous delivery, partly because of Selenium. We were doing all sorts of testing, of course, but including UI testing with Selenium as well. And I thought that there were a lot of bad things about how automated testing was done that in those days. So I switched to actually doing automated QA for almost a year. and I wasn't part of the development team, or like we were responsible only for testing, and there was a team doing actual software development. It was a complicated experience. I learned a lot about how non-optimal processes work in the teams, and how I would perceive them, how I would change them to be more optimal. But there were like one of the big problems when you have a separate teams for AQA and for development is that AQA cannot have a lot of impact on the development, and the opposite, because we're like separate teams, even though we work closely together. And developers, like I would be in many parts, I would be more experienced in the software development, but they would not take my advice because I was like from some other team. Like, but it was a big problem because for a lot of things that we wanted to do efficiently in testing, we were not able to change the code, and the code was not very testable. So from that on, I say to everyone, it's the developer who should write tests, and because then they will see that the way they wrote it, the code, the production code, is inefficient for testing, and they would maybe refactor.
Except maybe UI, right? So I think it's a lot of value if you have Playwright and stuff like that, or Cypress, but to have someone who just goes through the UI and sees whether everything is working in non-automated way, right?
Oh, yeah. Non-automated manual QA is for sure is a very good idea. Yeah.
Because otherwise the developer will test what I think is important, you know?
Yeah.
And if you get a user, even after some clicks, they will go a complete different path you will never expect, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Certainly, it's a very different angle of how they look at the app. And they're not just doing testing. Like these days, it's not a fashionable thing to have manual QA. But I think it's a big mistake because they have a very different perspective at things. Yeah. It's just the testing. They also do business analysis. They think about standardizing, like in one place on UI you call it this way, but on the other place on UI you call it another way, and you as a developer, you're too lazy to look at both things. But they look at the consistency, they help with the analysis a lot.
Okay, Selenium was rough, right? So lots of locks
definitely. Like you should, like if you do testing on all the levels, it should be a pyramid. You have a lot of low-level tests, and at the top, you have very few big tests, so that it's not as painful. So it doesn't matter if it's Selenium or Playwright. Still,
but Selenium was worse. Write. The cool story is Playwright runs in browser, and Selenium was a network protocol. You know, you could get.
They did communicate with the browser as well. Mm-hmm. It's a separate thing, but it does communicate with the browser through a separate port. And
Pretty cool. Crazy. No, your experiences. I had a similar experience, but different projects. So that's interesting. And what happened afterwards?
Then, like, I more and more started to think about science rather than software engineering. I wanted to do something like for the humanity, etc. So I started to study biology, and then
you studied biology?
Myself, not in actual university. And then eventually I found a job that allowed me to do scientific stuff, like work with the chemists and write software for chemists. So I switched to chemistry. And since then, I've been in chemistry for the last almost 11 years. I've been doing scientific projects.
I remember we met in the Java User Group Helsinki, and you had a great T-shirt. What was on the T-shirt?
Data Satanist. Yeah.
Ah, Data Satanist. Exactly. Yeah. This is actually great. So this is how I remember. It was a big impact with the Data Satanist.
Exactly. Yeah, if I'm ever in Munich or we cross paths, I can get you a T-shirt.
Very cool. By the way, the Helsinki Java User Group, it was incredibly well attended. So it was somehow reborn. It's still going strong. You attended another meeting?
No, unfortunately, it happens very rarely. Like in Helsinki, the idea is that most of the time, these groups, they found a company who would sponsor the meetup. but there were not that many Java companies in Helsinki. So
that's interesting, because I had a chat with the developers back then, and lots of them were Java developers. And
yeah, but you were on a concentrated event of Java developers. So
oh, okay, yeah, because I know Java user group is a Java concentrated event, right? So this is
yeah,
and okay. So and now you are working for the same company, right? About
so I started with the outsource, and now mm-hmm. I founded my own company.
What's the name of the company? So
it's called LC.
LC.
Yeah.
So what's the website?
ELSCI.io. Mm-hmm. So it's Electronic Sciences.
Electronic Sciences.io.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. .io. So yeah, we built a web and enterprise software for chemists mostly.
Mm-hmm. So elevator pitch. So how people can book you, your company, what's, you know, the main use cases, and just, you know.
So the biggest problem, like not an elevator speech, but the big problem, just so that you understand the scientific world, the big problem in science is that developers don't understand science, and they cannot mm-hmm. build good software for scientists.
Yeah.
So there is That's a disconnect
for me. Yeah.
There is a disconnect between what scientists need and what software developers think they need. And they cannot communicate properly. Scientists are very bad at explaining what they want. And so scientists dictate UI because, like, what should be on the UI, like which buttons, because software developers are very bad at understanding science, so they cannot think of for themselves. Another problem is that it's a cheap field, so it's very hard to find a good paying job in scientific fields. So it doesn't attract a lot of talent. So all in all, we end up with a very, very slow, very badly designed software in science. Like, it's through the whole industry. It's not like in banking, you can hire some top-notch software engineers. They would go do some microsecond stuff. It's very, very badly. So that's why I'm trying to be different. Trying to do like high performance, very user friendly stuff. Trying to be different.
Is it your company? Is it your company?
Yeah.
And how big is it? Or
6 people.
Cool. And you are the boss.
Yeah.
They are the hacking boss. This is very good.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not if I were to give advice to people who want to found a company, don't. Like, this is the worst thing for a software engineer.
Absolutely. Really, this is why I'm alone.
Very depressing.
You
know? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This is why I'm feeling so. So many opportunities. They ask me, if you create a company, you get a contract. And I say, yeah, but I would like, you know. And this was a very good decision because inversely can happen, you know. I'm out of contract, so I get different vacations, you know. But I have no, I don't have to care about projects and so. And so I'm free, actually. And really enjoy it still. So, but I know I'm almost alone. As I started in Germany, so we are lots of consultants back then, and almost anybody else started companies. They are now CEOs, CTOs. And if I met them, you know, it's like, and it's like, are you happy? And I say, yeah, but the programmer was great, right? So this is like the,
In the age of social networks, what you see on the social network is very drastically different from what people actually feel. Like, they would, mm-hmm. tell you about success, but eventually, at the end of the day, they are very depressed most of the time.
Yeah. And what is success? You have to be happy, right? It should be good enough. And then if you learn every day a little bit new, then you will be happier, I would say, than doing just job because your angel investor, whoever, decided that it's the right thing to do.
It's finances, a lot of finances, and also what adds stress is that you're not just responsible for yourself, you also have a team.
I really enjoyed your presentation in Helsinki, and I asked you then, what are you actually doing? And you said, science, this is actually crazy with Java, and you did virtual threats?
No. You asked me about virtual threats, but I said, I didn't
use it. You did threats, right? Threats in memory.
The talk was about how threads actually work underneath on the
Exactly. This was deep dive. Deep dive with, this was a great talk. Exactly. And then I thought about virtual threats and ask you, it's like, no, it's not that far. It was just real threats. How they map to platform threats. Okay, I remember. It was a great, great talk.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Listen, I have to re-invite you back. And the next topic, if you like, would be your company. What you are doing is just interesting. And then we can, from there branch to whatever. We can talk about CI/CD. By the way, your unit tests, I didn't mention that. I see this complete opposite way. So we can talk 1 hour about the pyramid, actually.
Mm, okay.
Because what I do in projects is I absolute must are end-to-end tests, and mm-hmm. unit tests are nice to have. Because what mm-hmm. I see, I'm consultant, so lots of task forces, and I never saw a project failing because of no unit tests, but always lack of end-to-end tests, stress tests, performance tests. So this is like, my bad experience yep. from the real world.
Yep.
And yeah. Now, where people can find you on the internet? What's your handle and your company? And I will put to the show notes. So if someone will hire you, or what is the best customer who should buy your services?
Ideally, it's a biotech company who wants to be mm-hmm. like who likes high quality stuff and mm-hmm. who wants their scientists to enjoy their work. Because even if there are software developers within the biotech companies, they still
mm-hmm.
like a lot of them don't have enough of expertise. People who understand science usually come from science and they become mm-hmm. software developers, but they don't have as much experience like working with the databases. Oof.
Yeah. So you will make scientists happier and more productive, right? This is actually
definitely.
The...
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Definitely.
So if BioNTech listens or whatever, they should hire you, right? Yeah, but not before the next show, because we need some time from you, to talk about important stuff, and then you can, sell your services everywhere. So thank you. What's the name of the company? What's your handle on social media?
It's ELCI, mm-hmm. LC. Uh-huh. My social is, I don't know. I'm usually on LinkedIn.
What your first and last name?
Stanislav Bashkirtsev. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's too long to pronounce, so I'd rather.
But yeah, put it in the show notes, no problem.
Yeah.
And the name of the company is ELCI, right?
Yeah.
Electronic Science.
Yeah.
And .io.
Yeah.
Perfect. So thank you a lot, and see you next time.
Okay. It was very, very nice chatting with you.
Yeah, I also enjoyed that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They say that every year the number of developers increases in some factor, maybe by two or whatever, and it means that most people that surround you after a couple of 3 or 5 years are the youngsters. So it's mm-hmm. sometimes very nice to meet someone from back in the day.
We are developer. 2-3 years older than the youngsters, so it's just a complete different generation. Thank you a lot.
Yeah, likewise.